Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Reagan Gillum, a host on the channel, and today we're talking to Dr. Badia Ahad Lagardi, who is the author of the book Afro-Nostalgia, Feeling Good in Contemporary Black Culture, published by the University of Illinois Press. Dr. Ahad Lagardi, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk to you about your book, Afro-Nostalgia, which is your second book. And your first book was Freud Upside Down, African-American Literature and Psychoanalytic Culture. And so your work is tied together through what seems to be a theme of uncovering affective sentiments that are generally overlooked in regard to the interiority of African-Americans. How do you come to this research theme, and how did you come to write Afro-Nostalgia?
Sure. So to be honest, Reagan, I cannot remember a time when I actually was not interested in kind of Black emotional life. And so that really was the impetus of Freud Upside Down. So really kind of thinking about how psychoanalysis was so important in the lives of African Americans from the early 20th century onward. So I've always really just been fascinated in kind of Black interiority, but in terms of Afro-Nostalgia in particular, I would say that something that I really wanted to talk about in my second book was, I don't know if it was just because I was feeling generally overwhelmed with sentiments of kind of grief, personal and societal, just feeling that there was so much emphasis and focus on Black violence and Black trauma. And a lot of my thinking around this book was really happening around the first iteration of the Black Lives Matter movement following the tragic death of Trayvon Martin. And, you know, I really just wanted to use my writing and my research as a reprieve from all of that, and to really highlight just another aspect of Black cultural, social, psychological, emotional life that had not really been explored. And that was really around sentiments of joy. So that led me to nostalgia. And in a kind of a circular way, but what we now know about nostalgia is that it's actually a sentiment that really does instill and generate feelings of joy and happiness. And it's often used as a coping mechanism to, you know, really deal with traumatic past events and also events in the present. And so it was really kind of an apt concept to explore at that particular time. And for better or for worse, it seems like a concept that is really resonant now.
Yeah, definitely. Nostalgia has emerged as a very powerful, you know, I don't know, affect, I guess, in this, that we're all paying attention to in this particular moment.
Yeah.
And so your central like concept of the book is, which is the title of the book, is Afro-Nostalgia. And I wanted to ask you if you could describe your idea. And so I'm going to just quote you. You write on page 20 that Afro-Nostalgia provides intellectual and affective ground from which to imagine new ways of Black being, Black doing, and Black feeling that enable flourishing under adverse social and political circumstances. So I was wondering if you could expand on this and describe your idea of Afro-Nostalgia.
Sure. So I really wanted to posit nostalgia as a formative aspect of Black life and Black experience, right? Something that I talk about in the book a lot, and I think when even people refer to the book, they refer to that kind of historical tidbit that nostalgia, or that in the 18th century, it was thought that Black people could not experience nostalgia, right? That we didn't possess the affective capacity to really experience that emotion, which I found really fascinating. And then in the book, I actually talk about Zadie Smith, and I think it was her NPR interview in which she described nostalgia, or historical nostalgia in particular, as something that was simply unavailable to Black people. But, you know, because I do a lot of work with emotions and affect and psychology, I knew, it was really clear to me, that nostalgia really is a feel-good emotion, right? So recent psychological studies have shown that nostalgia is really a great mechanism for coping. It's also a great mechanism for healing. And when I think about just the trajectory of Black life, you know, what would it mean to simply have nostalgia as something that is unavailable to us, right? And so rather than kind of thinking about it that way, I was really invested in just looking at how contemporary Black artists were actually engaging with the past in a way that I regarded as nostalgic, right? So in a way that wasn't, you know, trauma-laden, or one that wasn't really kind of framed through that particular lens, but really these just kind of looking at the ways in which these explorations of the Black historical past were taken up as a way to really instantiate good feelings. And so that was really kind of key, I guess, in the rather eclectic archive that I was producing in this book. And so kind of really thinking about how does nostalgia allow us to kind of cope with the difficult, as I said in the book, social and political circumstances of the moment, and to what end could that be put, right? So when we think about kind of historical or conventional understandings of nostalgia, it really kind of gets a bad rap because it's seen as kind of an impotent emotion, like, okay, so you retreat to the past, you hang out there, it may make you feel good in the moment, but it doesn't really do anything. And so I wanted to show that nostalgia actually has the ability to really inform not just our own kind of psychological lives in the way of well-being, but also like how that translates in a broader kind of social and political sense.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I found that really interesting in the book when you talked about, and you just mentioned it now, how there are these kind of like white psychological beliefs that Black people didn't experience nostalgia. And so you also distinguish Afro-nostalgia from sort of other ideas of like white nostalgia, which like seeks to recover an exclusionary past. And like one might think about these current debates about monuments and who should be commemorated with these ideas about nostalgia, these like dominant ideas about nostalgia. So how do you distinguish Afro-nostalgia against these other ideas about, racialized ideas about nostalgia?
Sure. So in terms of, you know, nostalgia, I always like to say that it's a complicated concept, right? But it's also a complicated emotion because it could really, you know, I talked about the extent to which it could be used for good. But I think we've also seen a lot of examples, especially within the last 4 years, of how nostalgia can have really grave implications, right? So when we even think about something like the mantra, you know, make America great again, right? Mm-hmm. That is really a nostalgic invocation of, I would say, white historical violence, right? So this idea that we want to return to this past that really just exists in the imaginary, right? And it's really meant to exclude, but it's also meant to really kind of create conditions of violence in many respects, right? Physical and otherwise. And so when you think about nostalgia, not only in that sense, but I would even point to Michelle Boyd's concept of Jim Crow nostalgia, right? The idea that, you know, there was this really glorious time of segregation when, you know, there were these flourishing Black businesses and, you know, Black janitors lived next door to Black doctors, you know, and it's really this kind of memory that is produced through acts of historical erasure, right? In really dangerous ways. So, you know, we're not trying to kind of recapture the past as it's imagined and that kind of make America great again moment. And we're also not trying to recapture the past in a way that is articulated through these kind of visions of this, you know, glorious Jim Crow era that really obscures, you know, the kind of state sanctioned violence that created those conditions to begin with, right? So the way that I would distinguish Afro-nostalgia from those more dangerous and kind of violent forms of nostalgia is to say that it's not a sentiment that is rooted in erasure. It's not a sentiment that really relies upon this kind of violent forgetting of the past. But it's really one that I would say is using the past as a resource, using the past as a framework to imagine a very different kind of possibility for the future. And I would say that one of the largest or biggest misconceptions about nostalgia is that it's a sentiment that is solely tied to the past. And really, nostalgia is a sentiment that is actually very invested in the future. And so that's the piece that I really wanted to kind of capture and hold on to for this work, and to really highlight how Black cultural producers now were kind of drawing upon historical memory and kind of historical scenes of the past in order to really think about new possibilities for the future. And that was what was really exciting to me about at least kind of my framing or my conception of Afro-nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so important. When I'm going to share a little story as a segue to the next question, sure. Where your idea of Afro-nostalgia, when you were talking about how the past is unavailable to African-Americans, it made me think about when I was younger, when I was in like the fifth grade, I remember reading Gone with the Wind. And my mom made this comment to me where she said, well, you know, if we were alive during those times, you wouldn't be Scarlett O'Hara, you know, you would be a person. And I remember it totally changed how I engaged with that book. And I think I was probably caught up in some of the romance. And I think my mom saw that and she just sort of cut it off at the past. And it made me think, like, you know, of what you were saying, where you're right, like the past is not always available as this like feeling of producing good feelings. So, yeah, I thought that demonstrated your concept, just in my own experience. And then it takes me to the first chapter of the book, because that's where you talk about slavery. Mm-hmm. And so in each chapter, you know, you talk about, you know, you break down Afro-nostalgia according to these different, characteristics, but in chapter one, you talk about what you call nostalgic retribution in relationship to new narratives about slavery. And they have this emphasis on the agency of the enslaved, and they seek justice for the enslaved by recreating stories about them. And I really liked when you had this discussion of this program called Ask a Slave, but you know, you also have other novels like The Good Lord Bird. And so the question, so how did this contemporary cultural production that you looked at, you know, refer to slavery and exhibit nostalgic retribution?
Sure. So I think for that chapter, what I really wanted to do was participate in a broader conversation around contemporary narratives of slavery, which, you know, if I am hard pressed, I would say that seems to be kind of the defining genre of contemporary Black literature, broadly speaking, that there are so many historical novels that kind of harken back to that moment. And now we are seeing this, I think, more and more even in popular culture. So, you know, I know that Good Lord Bird, for example, is now like a Showtime miniseries or something like that. I haven't seen it yet. But I also know that, you know, Colson Whitehead's The Underground Railroad, mm-hmm. Was just, you know, produced into a series as well, I think for Amazon. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems like, you know, these retreats, if you will, to the past are, becoming increasingly popular, not just as a literary form, but obviously as kind of other media. And, you know, just, I guess for me, I was really thinking about, as a broader genre, what purpose do these narratives serve, right? And because there's so many of them, right? So why is there this really big, I would say, push or kind of cultural imperative to return to that moment, and to what end? Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously there have been a lot of good books, essays, you know, written by people much smarter than myself about this kind of unreconciled relationship to the past, right? And really these texts function as a, you know, way of kind of grappling with this unfinished past, right? The fact that we're still seeing or kind of contending with the traumatic resonances of the transatlantic slave trade now in so many ways. But there's also another kind of element to these narratives that, you know, had not been fully fleshed out, at least in my view, which was the sense that there was a social justice project happening in these books, and there's the sense of wanting to frame these narratives as a form of recompense or redress. And so that is really what sparked this idea of kind of nostalgic retribution, right? So, you know, when we're kind of returning to this historical past, and I think I mentioned this in the book, it's not about returning to that past as it was, right? I really wanted to kind of think about these returns to the past as what could have been or what might have been. And just thinking about the ways in which these novels in particular work to shift hierarchies of power in particular ways, the ways in which they portray the enslaved characters in the book as agents in many respects, even though they may be in physical bondage, but the way in which they negotiate that and kind of navigate power and assert that, sometimes through like a very, what seems to me to be a very contemporary voice, like Ask a Slave, and in ways that seek to do justice, if you will, for those persons who may not have had the voice or the power to seek it for themselves in those moments. And so something I talk about in that chapter is how, you know, this isn't, you know, akin to Michelle Obama's kind of, you know, when they go low, you go high, but it's really about, you know, how these authors are invoking humor, how they're invoking different kind of rhetorical strategies as a way to give voice and to give power and agency and autonomy to these characters as an act of retributive justice. So that's really kind of what that chapter is all about.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I just started watching The Underground Railroad as well.
How is it?
I thought it's really good. It's really good. I've been enjoying it. I've only seen the first two. So
okay. I have to kind of force myself to watch film or television versions of books that I've read. Mm-hmm. So I always feel like, is this going to be as good as the book? Because it never really is, but I've heard good things. So I will check it out. But I always feel like I'm setting myself up for disappointment whenever I'm watching like the film version of like a book that I've read. So I don't know, but I'll check it out.
Yeah. I haven't read the book, so I need to, now I want to read the book. So
well, you know what happens? You read a book and as you're reading, you know, you've already begun the process of visualizing the characters, and they speak a certain way, they look a certain way. And then when, you know, the film or the television show comes out, they don't look anything like the characters as they existed in your head when you were reading. So that's always kind of, at least to my mind, why the movie or the television show is never as good as the book. But I know that Barry Jenkins is a very talented director. So I'm assuming that that justice was done in that case. So I will check it out.
No, for sure. And yeah, and like speaking of the visual, I wanted to ask you also about the cover of the book, because it is really beautiful. And it's a collage by the artist Krista Franklin. And it aligns with your discussion in chapter 3, which is on nostalgic regeneration, and the work of three Black female artists, April Banks, Krista Franklin, and Rhonda Wheatley. And you argue that their work offers these new narratives of pleasure. And I thought the cover was like a great invitation into this world, or into the world of Afro nostalgia, but also into this idea of regeneration. So how did you decide on the cover of the book? And how does this express Afro nostalgia?
Yeah. So Krista Franklin is actually a Chicago artist. She's also a very well-known poet. So I actually have been following her work for quite some time. A friend of mine who is a really accomplished art historian kind of pointed me in the direction of Franklin a few years ago. And I've been just, you know, honestly in love with everything that she touches from then on. But I was really kind of interested in Krista Franklin because nostalgia is a primary thematic in her visual work, but it's also, you know, plays a pretty big role in her poetry as well. So just kind of thinking about how she actually engages nostalgia in many of the same ways that I've kind of been thinking about it as this retreat to kind of Black historical joy, right? Or you know, Black historical pleasure. And the piece. Oh, are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The piece on the cover is actually called Lush Life. And I just love the cover, love the title, partially because this idea of lush life, as sad as this may be, it's so counterintuitive in terms of the way that we normally talk about and think about Black life.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, it's the cover is, it's a technicolor, it's luxuriant, it's vibrant, it's rich. So I think I've garnered Krista many more fans because of the cover of this book. But really, I think it also points to kind of a broader Black feminist imperative of care. And I chose that term kind of regeneration largely because of its medical connotation, right? That this idea that after a loss or after an injury, something is able to grow back in a new and sometimes even better form. And so I really wanted to kind of play with this idea of the traumatic as, you know, the loss, if you will. But then what comes out of that in maybe a new or better form? And this is something that really is at the heart of the work of the three artists that are featured in that chapter. But it really does kind of align with a lot of the kind of Black feminist work around kind of care and pleasure, you know, thinking about let's see, like Joan Morgan's Why We Get Off, right? That kind of talks about like the politics of pleasure, Adrienne Marie Brown, Brittany Cooper. So that chapter, it was so much fun to write, but I have to say, I felt, talk about feeling good. I felt so good writing every bit of that chapter because it really was, I think as you kind of pointed out, just so overwhelmingly focused on, you know, the cultivation of joy and the cultivation of pleasure, especially for Black women. So I needed that chapter when I wrote it, and I need it now.
Definitely. I love the visuals in the chapter, and I loved looking at them, and I wanted them to go to an exhibition to see them. It was really great.
Yeah, I mean, the Rhonda Wheatley works that I talked about were, you know, those were actually an installation in Chicago at the Hyde Park Art Center. And I was, I think I talked about this in the book, but I was teaching an honors class at the time. And, you know, college students never get field trips. And so they were really excited to take a field trip. But we were talking about, the class was on contemporary novels of slavery. And so I actually wanted them to see this exhibit to kind of, you know, understands like, you know, this is what we're kind of talking about in this novel, in these novels, but these concepts, these themes have a broader cultural resonance. And it's not just in kind of the form of the book, if you will, but that not all kind of Black returns to the past are founded in the traumatic. And so I wanted them to actually see Wheatley's exhibit, which was actually pretty interactive too, as kind of a counterpoint to that. So it was a great experience for them. So, and I do know that April Banks actually has a installation in Los Angeles. I think it's called Justice and Joy. Mm. So she's continuing this work in really amazing ways too.
Mm-hmm. I'll have to go see that since it's right here. And so in the book, you include these like personal recollections like laced throughout the text. And so for example, you talk about in chapter 4, which is nostalgic reclamation, you discuss, for example, your childhood growing up in the Nation of Islam and how you couldn't eat pork. And, you know, this dovetails, of course, with the theme of the chapter, which is Black culinary creativity. And, you know, you look at different chefs like Marcus Samuelson and Bryant Terry. But I also wondered, why was it important to you to include these personal moments that you weave throughout the text?
Sure. Well, it's really interesting because a lot of people have said that the fourth chapter is like their favorite chapter because it is personal, which I thought was really interesting. I'm like, who really cares that much about my own kind of experiences? But I wrote about them. So I guess, you know, I was hoping that they would resonate with other people. But I feel like food is so personal. And when we think about nostalgia, even in a really conventional sense, you know, what is it that generates nostalgia? And it's usually food and music. Those are kind of the top two things that really kind of have this capacity to transport us to a past. And that past can be personal, that past can be historical in some ways, but it really is kind of an invitation to really kind of indulge in this to indulge in the past. And so that's one of the reasons why it was really important to include those personal moments. But I also had done so much to kind of talk about historical nostalgia in the book. And so I really wanted the food chapter to veer into the personal, but then to show how those two are also intertwined. And so it's not just obviously about my own kind of personal food memories, but how those are tied to, you know, my upbringing in the Nation of Islam, how that is tied to broader nostalgic ideas about this, you know, I would say largely kind of imagined African past, if you will. So I wanted to kind of, you know, show how all of those are kind of working together to kind of produce this broader conception of Afro-nostalgia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really like that chapter as well. I love reading about food. And so
yeah. Most people do.
Definitely. And I really like Marcus Samuelson and Bryant Terry. I have both of their cookbooks.
Oh, really?
Yeah, multiple cookbooks from both of them. So I actually really liked reading the chapter a lot.
Oh, I'm happy to hear that. And, you know, Terry, you know, he was really just fascinating to write about. And it was also, to be frank, a lot of fun just kind of following his work and you know, following the recipes and his cookbooks in the way that he suggests. So, you know, he gives you reading, he gives you music, you know, so it almost kind of creates this, you know, broader kind of sensory experience as you're kind of working through the various recipes. And so it was really kind of interesting even doing that as part of the quote unquote research for the chapter. So I'm glad to hear that, you know, some of the fun and some of the kind of energy around that that process came through in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And so I wanted to ask you about the researching of the book as well. And so you mentioned that you put together this eclectic archive. And so each chapter gathers a cohort of examples that you use to demonstrate, you know, your central concepts and theory. And I wondered kind of how you went about gathering the material. Did you sort of start with the concept and then start to notice it enacted through different texts and work? Or was it kind of serendipity that these examples came together? And I asked this to as someone who just kind of finished writing my own book. And so I think it's really valuable to hear about, you know, other people's processes.
Sure.
How they went about collecting this material.
Sure. Well, first of all, congratulations on finishing your book. So I'm excited to see that when it comes out in the world. But, you know, I wouldn't say that it was serendipity. These are actually, you know, concepts that I had been, or ideas I've been thinking about for a really long time. So when I finished Freud Upside Down, I had already been kind of thinking about nostalgia. So, you know, Freud Upside Down was making its way in the world. You know, I was certainly kind of, well, this is an interesting phenomenon that I don't know if many people talk about, but, you know, by the time the book reaches, you know, the public, if you will, you've been done with it for a little while. And so, it is quite common, I hear, that you're already on to the next idea when everyone else is kind of just getting introduced to the one in the book. So I have been kind of thinking about nostalgia, and I actually wrote an article on Marcus Samuelson and Yes Chef, and nostalgia was kind of the, I would say it wasn't explicit, but it was certainly like the underlying theme in the article. And I was so invested in that concept and food, as we just talked about, that I literally wrote the article in like a month. Like I was just, I had it penned up in me, and I just wrote from there. And then I kind of turned to an article I had been thinking about on Dave Chappelle's Block Party. So, and that one got published as well. So I published these two pieces, and just kind of looking at them together, it was very clear to me that nostalgia was my thing, that this was going to be kind of the central theme of whatever it was I worked on next. And what was really fascinating is that even though I'm a literary scholar, neither of these articles was about literature necessarily. So that's when I knew that I wanted to explore how this idea was kind of coming together and larger kind of cultural registers. And I think it's one of those things that when you have an idea and you then set yourself upon doing a lot of reading and writing and paying attention, that artists' works, you know, different kinds of cultural works start emerging, or you start thinking about them in a particular way. And that is honestly how, you know, the book came together. I just really started kind of, I guess, being really attentive to kind of what was already extant in terms of kind of, you know, Black cultural works, but then also starting to dig a little deeper in the works of people who, you know, I knew were kind of exploring this as at least an ideation in their own art. So like I mentioned, Krista Franklin is someone whose visual works that I've, you know, been really attracted to for quite some time. But that then led me to Krista Franklin as a poet and finding even more material there, if you will, that really spoke to what I was trying to do in the book. So I would say that, you know, perhaps maybe, you know, it was part serendipity, but I also think it was part just really wanting to be a bit of a curator in some respects and really bring together this body of Black aesthetic cultural productions that were really invested in alternatives to the traumatic. And that's what really kind of led me to the various pieces in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so speaking of that, like this has kind of been a theme that you've been kind of talking about, it's like feeling good, the alternatives to the traumatic. And I found that as a reader who is a Black woman and an African-American woman, I found the book to be very generative of these good feelings. And you kind of also said this too, and we talked about chapter 3, it was the chapter that, you know, that you needed and things like that. And so I was wondering maybe when you were writing the book or even now and seeing the reception, if you thought about, I guess, the audience for the book, and how the book would also kind of generate these very feelings that you're describing. Like in a way, I found the book to also be very therapeutic in producing these good feelings.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, it's nice to know that sometimes when, you know, a project starts to feel a little self-indulgent and you just hope that it resonates with the outside world, that it's actually doing that job. So that's really nice to hear. And I appreciate that. That insight into the book and what it was like for you to kind of engage with it as a reader. I would say that no, this is not a book where I was overly conscious of audience, except that it was clear to me that I was not the only person who was wanting something else, right? And this just kind of emerges in various, you know, popular cultural snippets that I would, you know, come across. So in the book, I think I talked about the NPR interview or program with Neil Drumming, in which he, you know, was talking about his desire for a parallel narrative, I think is what he called it, right? So something else to like offset just the persistent, you know, spectacles of Black death that were just, it seemed like it was kind of flooding our social media and our images on the screen. But just this kind of, I would say, weariness of being overwhelmed with stories of Black violence and that thinking that this can't be all that there is. And you know, there's this line that I refer to, I think it's in the last chapter by playwright Susan Laurie Parks, in which is something, I'm paraphrasing, but it's something like, you know, is being Black, or does being Black mean that you're always blue or something like that? So this idea that it's trauma rather than joy, that's our birthright in some respects. And so I really wanted to play around with, you know, the idea that there is this parallel narrative, that there is something else out there. And even if it's not, going back to kind of the Zadie Smith comment, you know, historically available to us in ways that we're able to kind of readily recognize, we can certainly see how it has been invented, right, in popular culture in particular. And so, for example, you know, just going back to the comment that you made about Gone with the Wind, right, that, you know, this idea that there isn't a place for you in that history, so to speak. Well, you know what, maybe not, right? But when I look at something like Bridgerton, for example, you know, and obviously this is a fictional work, but let's think for a moment about what engenders, you know, that kind of creation, right? Why do we need a Bridgerton? Why was it so popular? Why did it speak? I mean, I could not, when it first came out, there was not a day on social media that wasn't like just talking about all of the drama and all of the kind of hoopla, if you will, around the series. And, you know, obviously, you know, it's a Shondaland production, if you will, but I think it also points to this kind of broader desire that I was kind of speaking to earlier for a different kind of narrative to emerge, for Black people to kind of show up in these historical spaces in ways that are not subjugated or subservient, right? But in ways that are aesthetically beautiful and powerful and intriguing and interesting and multidimensional. And I think that, so with that, I wasn't thinking necessarily about, you know, this audience for Afro nostalgia in that way, but I believe that what I was aware of, at least at the time, was that there was this want for a different kind of narrative. And, you know, that's what I was really hoping to kind of pull together in the book.
So you mentioned this too, just previously. And I was going to say, I follow you on Twitter. And I see some of your tweets that make note of how Afro nostalgia is alive and well in contemporary Black life. And so maybe Bridgerton would be an example of this, but I was wondering if you see other ways in which Afro nostalgia is working in contemporary culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think that I feel like I should have referenced my or gone back to my Twitter to see like what was I talking about when I said that. But I believe that, you know, I've made mention of that or kind of brought attention to it whenever I see this really conscious cultivation of Black historical joy, the kind of conscious retreat to a Black historical past in ways that are meant to engender good feelings. So Bridgerton is obviously one example. In other contexts, I've talked about, you know, Sylvie's Love, which was, you know, the movie that was done, I think it was for Amazon. But, you know, even reading about, you know, the kind of critical commentary around that film, which is a period piece. And you don't get a lot of Black period pieces, just by the way. You certainly don't get a lot of them that are truly and solely a love story. that, you know, there's not this kind of traumatic backdrop. You know, it's not centered around some historically tragic event, right? It's just a love story. And I have to say that when I saw it the first time, I was waiting for the other shoe to drop through the entire thing. Like, I couldn't even fully enjoy it the first time I saw it because I was thinking, oh no, something's going to happen to either one of them just because of the period in which they existed, and because I had become so socialized to watching or reading, you know, Black people existing in the past, that in which there was, in which their demise or them being the victim of some, you know, terrible form of violence was completely inevitable, right? And so to be able to kind of just sit and enjoy this love story set in the, you know, 1960s was such a rare and odd and beautiful experience. I had to watch it again so that I could actually fully embrace what was happening. Because there was not another shoe to drop, if you will. There was just the love story that was presented to us. And I think that we're deserving of that. And I think that we all want to see a little bit more of that. Because it also does a lot in the way of depicting Black folks as fully human. Mm-hmm. And we all know this to be true, but we just don't see it represented widely in a way that I know that I would like to see. So for me, that's when I say that kind of nostalgia, Afro nostalgia is alive and well, is because I am really wanting to kind of highlight, movies and films and books and, experiences like this that really do show that, Black folks are capable of experiencing, the full range of emotions, and that we have access to those, and that, they mean something to us.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so to conclude, I guess, the interview, I was going to ask, do you have any projects on the horizon now that Afro Nostalgia is out into the world? And I realize that we're coming out of a pandemic, so, maybe these are, projects that are very much on the horizon, but, or just anything you have, coming up, I guess, that you're working on.
Yeah, right now I am finishing up an essay that we're writing as part of a special journal issue. So it's Habiba Ibrahim and I are editing a special issue of the South Atlantic Quarterly. And the theme is Black temporality in times of crisis. So coming out of a pandemic, it couldn't be more timely, I guess. But we're really excited about that. So we're wrapping that up now. And some amazing essays from really great contributors for that piece. So that'll be out in April 2022. I have a few pieces that are currently under review that ironically talk about leisure, idleness, and reclamation of Black time. I feel like I'm not getting a ton of rest, but but at least I'm doing a lot of research about leisure and rest. So I don't know if that counts for something. So, those are kind of out in the world right now. And, other than that, I think, I have some inklings of an idea of another book project, but I'm also really, kind of enjoying, not writing a book right now. and allowing myself to kind of just be open to what comes next.
That sounds amazing. So we'll look out for those projects and, the South Atlantic Quarterly, the one that will be coming out, I guess, most closely.
Yep.
Oh, great. So I've been talking to Dr. Badia Ahad Lagardi, who is the author of the book Afro Nostalgia, Feeling Good in Contemporary Black Culture, published by the University of Illinois Press. Thank you so much for writing this book and for sharing it with us on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
It was great speaking with you as well. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.